Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Oh, hey, love your shoes. If you're hearing this, this is your sign to try those on. Trust us, you can totally pull them off. In fact, try on every shoe here if you want. We won't stop you. In our house, you've got unlimited freedom to play. And hey, fall is the perfect season to do, wear, be whatever you want. And with tons of shoes that get you at prices that get your budget, we'll give you something to brag about. So go ahead, try them on. Let us surprise you.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
Talk to anybody in your family. Odds are that somebody in your immediate family knows someone who ran there, or whose parents ran there, or they know somebody who ran or goes to it. Everybody in Philadelphia has that kind of a connection.
And our guest this week is Dave Johnson. He spent a quarter century as the Frank Dolson director of the Penn Relays until he decided to retire in 2020. And Dave, thanks so much for the time.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
So what are you doing these days?
I'm trying to get back to the things I wanted to do when I was going to retire, projects that had been set aside for a good time, and presumably retirement was going to be that time, but you keep holding on to some of the things. I'm trying to divest, but it comes slowly.
How are you? You're still connected, I would imagine, with the Relays in some way?
I am. It's mostly the oddball question that comes in. How do you handle sanctioning for an island country out of the Caribbean that hasn't been here recently? And, what certain rules do you have to work through to get everybody on board to sanction that team, or, things like that, things that were always sort of an on-the-spot decision back when I was there. Just from experience, you'd know where you had to lean and how you had to navigate certain situations. The trick was always to avoid an interviewer who would want to ask, well, why has this become a problem? I said, well, it's not a problem. It's a situation right now. If we don't handle the situation, then it's a problem. But we don't have any problems right now, so we're in good shape.
Why did you make the decision to step away when you did?
I was getting too tired to be waking up at 5 in the morning with the butterflies going and not getting to bed until 11 or 12 or 1. And that was for the last 4 to 6 weeks leading into Relays. And then the nervous exhaustion afterwards didn't change the sleep much either. And there was a day in around 2019, I think, that I was getting ready to get into the Relays office on the Saturday morning of Relays and realized I am now older than anybody who's been in this chair. And that was in 2019. So it was – I knew I'd been trying to work out an exit strategy, and then COVID hit. So I was there in 2020, and COVID shut us down in mid-March. And then in a little earlier in 2021, we realized – we couldn't get back on track that year either. So between COVID and retirement, everything meshed well for turning over the reins.
For people who aren't familiar, I think a lot of people love the pen relays, but have no appreciation for what goes into it. It's a handful of days in April. Would you be starting for the next year's relays the day after this year's relays concluded?
Oh, no, that's much too late. The easy way to market in the days when everything was done on paper was that the first time we received a response to a question, say, and I realized you can't ask, would you prefer this or that? And when you get an answer that says yes, you realize, okay, we have to be more specific. And that's the date that starts next year's relays, when you realize we have to rewrite that question or anything along those lines. So it's really, in that regard, it's a 16 to 18 month process. Now the planning on a macro scale that involves city development, bridge closings, highway work. We had a big problem when South Street closed, but we had 2.5 years of preparation for that and trying to figure out where traffic would flow, what we needed to do on with the vending that used to be out on 33rd Street. That we had a good bit of time to plan for that and used all that time.
Did you have any appreciation when you came into this role, I think in 95, that it would involve so much? And when I mean that, like, that it would involve understanding traffic flow, that it would understand, you'd need to understand vending contracts and things like that? Or did you come in under the naive guise that it's a huge undertaking, but focusing on just the athletics standpoint?
Well, I'd worked on putting the program together in April of 1979. I'd been involved managing the results crew for the next 8 years, I guess, and then spent 1 year working with Herb Hartnett when he was a director of communications, and that was the 88 relays. And then after that, I moved over to the relays office and was either assistant or associate director for 7 years before taking on the reins.
So you had a very good idea of how the sausage was made.
I had a good idea of it, but there were divisions of what Tim Baker, my predecessor, and I did in the office. I handled a lot of what went into the seating of certain events and getting all that information over to the people who put the program together. I was also involved with making certain the results came out well, the timing systems were working properly, and anything that was of a financial nature, that was completely Tim's bailiwick. So that's where I had to get involved. I'd had a good indoctrination into contractual negotiations, and you know, it had been that up through, I'd say, about 98 or so, 97 maybe, we'd handled a lot of contract negotiations within the relays office. But as the relays grew bigger and the financial implications became greater, that was moved out of our office, and we then had full-time marketing staff for the department. So that shifted out. But we'd have I'd have meetings that would involve, say, security concerns. And that would involve Penn Campus Police, Philadelphia Traffic, Philadelphia Police. And they would – Philadelphia Police would then be the connecting pathway to state police and other agencies.
Was it safe to say that every year you were the director, there was a unique problem that only showed up that one time?
Yes, yes. Or there were some years where an ongoing problem was exacerbated. The biggest ongoing problem was death within our Corps of Officials. And there was 1 year between retirements and passings that we lost, I think, 11 people in 1 year. And the problem is that the volunteers who come in, the officials who work, have worked long enough within their team that they know each other's jobs on one side of what they do and on the other side of what they do. They might not know the whole scope of, say, the clerking involvement, but everybody can cover for the person who's always sitting at their elbow. But with certain people, with a retirement or a passing, you suddenly realize after the meet that, you know, something fell through the cracks. You know what? Bob did that, or Larry did that and always handled that. We just didn't know it. People would see a problem and take it upon themselves to work through it. You know, and it's an ongoing situation that has to be, you know, if it's a matter of getting people in through the gate, into the grandstand or onto into the paddock for clerking. You know, there's always a congestion. There are pinch points for the people trying to get in or moving. And no matter how you plan for it, there's always going to be a pinch at a certain time, depending upon the schedule that day or depending on the weather. You know, one of the biggest problems was always a Thursday or Friday morning rain when all traffic on the Schuylkill slows down dramatically and it's a work day. So people are coming in here at rush hour and, you know, you always just had to deal with it.
So beyond your connection with the relays, I know as a journalist, you also had an extensive history covering track and field. What's your origin story with the sport? Was it just fandom? Did you do it in high school? Like what kind of was the gateway that got you so interested where the idea of track and field became such a passion for you?
Getting dragged out to cross country my junior year in high school by one of my best friends who had been a quarter miler on the track team his sophomore year. And the cross country team in 66 had graduated its top four runners. And the track coach said, okay, everybody who's on the track team who runs a quarter mile or farther, you have to come out for cross country next year. No more being third string wide receiver in football. That does you, the football team, you're just fodder, and we need to rebuild a team. And not only do you have to come out, you have to bring someone with you. So I was the bring along.
The plus one, if you will.
I was the plus one that year. And that's what got me hooked. Suddenly I found I was a varsity athlete for the first time. And it was a good feeling to be an integral part of a team, not just, oh, well, maybe I'll get to play today and, you know, go in the last two innings, or I'll be playing left field because our normal left fielder is homesick today. You know, so it was nice to be able to be part of a team and become an integral part.
And that was at Swarthmore High?
Swarthmore High School, yes.
So did it take with you right away, the idea of running, or did it take some time to really get into it?
It took me – it came very quickly. And much later – at the time I thought, you know, I found a sport where diligence and persistence really pays off more than any persistence I've shown in other sports. This is paying off right now. And much later in life, I realized that having been a paper boy and wanting to finish my route as fast as possible so I could get home, play backyard basketball or touch football or whatever. You know, I was cross training all year round, just trying to go to school as late as possible, which meant you were running. Getting home as quickly as possible to change clothes meant you were running. We ran a lot when we were kids. And bicycled, you know, so I was always cross-training, just didn't know it, didn't even know the term.
Favorite part of running?
Being in such good shape that you can run crisply, smoothly, through almost any kind of terrain, and you're just flowing as if there's a lot more to give, but you can run a 5:30 pace and not feel like it's taking anything out of you. You're not grinding. And so that was the real thrill. The backside of that was that I knew how much training it took to get to that point, and I wasn't willing to do that on my own once I was getting out of college. So college was the end of my running.
And you went to Swarthmore College.
Swarthmore College, yeah.
Distance running, is it a more difficult battle physically or mentally?
I don't know is a bad answer to a tough question, but I always found it curious that some people were terrific practice runners. I had one when I coached, had a teammate who was like that, dominated workouts, and had difficulty living up to that in a race, or just couldn't break up through beyond that. And I was, if anything, the opposite. I liked the challenge of the test that day. And whatever I'd done was going to be there or not. The trick was overcoming the psychological disadvantage of thinking that I needed to run with that guy on that team if we're going to beat them. And it wasn't until my senior year in college, after 6 years of running, that I finally relaxed enough and gave my best race of the year in the race that mattered most and in which I was needed to score. It's the only time that happened. The other times when I ran well were times when I was, say, sixth man on the team. So it was nice to finally figure that out after 6 years of running.
Did you always figure you were going to go into journalism or writing? Was that always the plan?
No, never was. I was never a member of a student newspaper in high school or college.
What'd you major in?
Majored in religion, which at one time seemed to be a vocational choice early, but I got sidetracked from Christian religions into Asian religions and discovered a symbiotic relationship within my own soul. So that and other life choices pulled me away from anything involving the ministry, really.
So what's the on-ramp to journalism?
I was approached by a couple friends, coaches at local high schools in, the winter of 76, 77, about reestablishing a statewide publication covering high school track. There had been one that lasted about 2 years in the early 70s, and it died when the editor's son graduated from high school. Or graduated from college, I guess, by then. And they wanted to recreate that and sat down, talked with me. Would I be interested in becoming the editor? I said, yeah. I didn't have a full-time job at the time. I said, yeah, I'd be interested in that. I thought they were going to pitch me some money and fund the thing. No, that was on me also. So I created something called Philadelphia Track. I did an annual for the 77 indoor high school season for the Delaware Valley five-county area, which is basically District 1 plus Philadelphia back then, Catholic League, Public League, Interac, and the independent schools in the five counties. And then I did an outdoor booklet and then an indoor booklet for 78. And by then, I realized this is not I love doing the work. I like collecting the stats and meshing it all together and writing up what had happened in each event over the course of the year. But the idea of having to go out and sell it, I had done some groundwork and talked to coaches. And, coaches said, yeah, for a buck and a half, I'll buy a copy for each team, each member of the team. I figured, great, I've got some easy paths. Well, that one coach who had 45 kids on his track team, said, well, thanks for the first copy. But you know what? All the kids just come and look at it in the office or take it home for a night. We really don't need to be spending $60 or something, out of our travel budget for this. But it's a great job, thanks. So I realized this was a great way to lose money quickly. And it was not a good investment of time. But in the process, I was at a really good track meet down in at the Naval Academy and came home. And then on neither Sunday nor Monday was there any story about the meet. I ran into Bob Savette, who was a track writer at the Bulletin at the time. I said, great meet down there. How come nobody covered it? And I said, how many reporters do you think we have covering track and field? I said they had Bob Savette and they had Julius Thompson on high school sport track. And, but Julius also covered basketball. So, there was nothing there. And they said, but you could be a stringer. I says, okay, so what's a stringer? But that was became my biggest earning source for 2 years in 78 and 79. And it was wonderful. And Philadelphia was about the only major city in the country with four major dailies, because we had the Bulletin, the Inquirer, the Daily News, and the Journal was going at that time. So I had four outlets there, although the Daily News didn't have a Sunday paper. They'd catch up on Monday if things were important. Then there were all the local county papers. And I, each of those years, I hitchhiked out to Bloomington, Indiana for the National Junior Championships.
Literally hitchhiked?
Literally hitchhiked, yeah. Got to save money. And the meet would be college freshmen for the most part and high school kids. And Delaware Valley at the time was terrific. The Philadelphia Public and Catholic Leagues were on a very high peak at the time. So Public League had Rod Wilson and Carlton Young and great relay teams. In one of those years, four of the eight final teams in the Championship of America 4x4 at Penn were Philadelphia City Schools. And then across the river, you had Carl Lewis and Willingboro coming up at the same time. So it was a tremendous time, plus great recruiting classes at Villanova, Temple, LaSalle, St. Joe's, Penn. A lot of talent to be talked about at the National Juniors. And so I got about 10 different paychecks from that meet, ranging from anywhere from $60 to $100, because it was a two-day meet, which was also very nice. The trick was filing stories the second day, because by then maybe I was hooking a ride with someone going back, and we'd be leaving that evening, and I'm trying to file stories, always call the rewrite desk, give them my opening graph, and then make up two graphs on the spot, just talking over the phone about the people in their area that was really important to their readership. So that's the way that came about. It was a side door. My whole career has been looking for the side door. And never quite the back door, but never entirely the front door either. You know, it wasn't banging on a door asking for a job.
When you're covering meets, I would imagine at a lot of these meets, there's a lot of things happening at the same time. How long did it take you to be able to understand when you needed to pay attention to things?
Oh, probably in Penn Relays 1968. That was the first year that, it was a year when Villanova became the first team to win five Championship of America relays in 1 year. And my coach, who lived out in central part of Delaware County, so well beyond Swarthmore by another 10, 15 miles, wanted to beat the traffic. So we were walking out of the stadium and heard this enormous roar from the stands. So we knew something had happened. Villanova probably won the mile relay to close the event, but we didn't know. And it wasn't something that appeared on the 11 o'clock news, because 11 o'clock Sunday news back then was 15 minutes starting at 11 o'clock. And the sports was, what did the Phillies do? And by the end of April, back in 1968, the Flyers, I don't think, mattered. And the Sixers did. But it was the three majors, and that's it for sports. And so I'm waiting for the Bulletin to come out the next day to see that Larry James had run the fastest relay leg ever to anchor the mile relay. And Villanova had won their five. And Abington High School had won the high school championship mile relay, the first Delaware Valley school to win that race since 1943, I think it was. So lots of great stories in the paper that day. But I learned that you don't walk out before the end of the meet.
Did you ever run in the Penn Relays?
No. Well, did I compete? No. Did I run? Yes. 1988 was Tim Baker's first year as director, and we were looking for media coverage, so we put on a media relay. And among eight teams on the track were two teams from Track and Field News, Track and Field News East and Track and Field News West, and I ran the leadoff for the West team because I'd been out of Track and Field News for 8 years before coming back here. And we finished next to last. We beat the Track and Field News East team.
Bragging rights.
And yeah. And we were probably a full straight. Well, I'm sure we were a full straight, the final straightaway behind the next to last team. So, you know, the two of us held up the rear very well. It's called having the appropriate anchor men.
We need to take a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Dave Johnson in just a couple of moments. But right now, there's nothing quite like the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid when it comes to exhilarating efficiency. With hybrid technology and thrilling capability, these vehicles deliver an electrifying performance on every drive. Discover for yourself what truly makes these hybrids special. Redefine your driving experience with Honda, KBB.com's best value brand of 2023. Contact your local Honda dealer today about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with the former director of the Penn Relays, Dave Johnson.
Now, you covered four Olympic Games, am I correct?
In various capacities, more than that. Let me think. My first Olympics was 84 when I was a journalist. 88, I was not there. 80, you know, with the boycott, I was not in Moscow. But 84, 92, I worked for NBC as a sideline reporter. I was feeding information and likely questions to Todd Christensen. 96, I was one of three spotters and information coordinators in the public address booth. And then in 2000, is that where we are? Yeah, 2000 in Sydney, I worked for the local organizing committee, writing stories each day. And let's see, I've not been to an Olympics since then. It's either too exhausting or too expensive, and it's going to be one or the other. The trick is to figure out whether it's worthwhile, and I can go to three or four world championships for the same amount of money, essentially. And enjoy the meet much more.
Why enjoy it more?
I'm working less, or let's say my responsibilities are less, or my travel. In Sydney, a friend and I were staying at a friend of his out about 2 hours outside of from where the stadium was in Sydney, and 2 hours leaving at around 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night, and then getting on the train coming back in by about 7:30 or 8 in the morning leads to a pretty rough day. You know, you're doing all this in 5 hours sleep or so, and realizing that Sydney weather was beautiful, comfortable to work in, with the exception of one terrific downpour the night of the women's 400. But I knew that in 2004 in Athens, the temperatures were going to be 20 and 30 degrees hotter every day. And it was going to be, if I had to do that with that little sleep, it just was not going to be a particularly enjoyable time. So I've pretty much spent my own money to go to world championships. And until 2017 was the London meet. That was the first of the outdoor world championships that I'd missed. So I'd gone to every one. They had been quadrennial for three editions, and then they went biennial after 91. And so I'd been to all of them until 2017.
Specifically with the Olympics, did you have moments where you were able to take a step back and go, I'm at the Olympics? Or were you so busy with the grind you discussed where it almost went by in a flash because you're so focused on the next responsibility and trying to get through the day and making sure everything. Were you able to take a couple of moments to enjoy the pageantry and the being a piece of that?
Yeah. The best example was that in 1992, Walt Murphy, as a friend, longtime colleague from New York, he and I were working with NBC. And we were involved with – we had to stay over – at the end of the meet, because the NBC morning show was emanating live from Barcelona. So a six-hour time zone difference to New York meant that we were going on air at 1 in the morning. And we'd be done at 3 and wrap up at 3:30. and walk down the mountain to get buses back to, you know, and 45 minutes away to where our lodgings were. But we could walk down the mountain for the 1.5-2 hour break we had for lunch every day. And as you walked down the mountain, you went past the diving facility. And I remember watching Greg Louganis being lined up perfectly so you could see Louganis on a one dive go up in the air and go over, visually over the mountain that was in the background. And it was just perfectly arched right over the mountain. So that was, you know, that was sort of Olympic pageantry at its best. But in terms of the track, no, the other best time was the parade of athletes at the conclusion of the first World Championships in 83, when the athletes broke ranks from and didn't just walk around with their teams. They just ran over. They were all over the place walking around the track with colleagues, competitors, teammates, and watching Eamon Coghlan be paraded around by the Irish team was terrific. I'd been an Eamon Coghlan fan since his years at Villanova and saw him, knew that he'd taken fourth in the 1500 in 76 Olympics and fourth in the 5000 in 1980. And here he is in 83, and he wins the world championship in the 5000. And coming down the home stretch, just puts his hands out, shrugging his shoulders and looking around like, what happened? Where is everyone? Because I think there were about eight people with a chance to win with a lap to go. It was a very slowly paced kicker's race. And Eamon just blew them all away. Only one person left at the with 180 meters to go, and that was, I think, Valery Abramov from the Soviet Union. And Eamon just put him away as they were coming into the straight. And that's when the shrug was, where is everyone?
So the pen relays, why do they resonate with people? I think unlike any other track meet in the country, what is it about the pen relays that make them the pen relays?
Age, the fact that it's become, well, first of all, let's go back. I would take this question down a notch. There are lots of meets have terrific followings. What pen relays has going over all those other meets, though, is longevity, a large stadium, which is wonderful acoustically with an overhang over that large first deck, an overhang that comes out so far that it funnels sound right to the track. So the volume of noise in there is very difficult to match. So you get that type of aural energy. You've got the fact that it is so old makes this a family gathering. You have multiple generations attending the relays each year, three generations. I've seen four generations of one family together. And the fact that the pace is such that there's no downtime between events. One way I've marked the success of the whole enterprise is the percentage of time between the last finisher of one race and the starting pistol going off for the next race, and what percentage of the total time of the meet is that delay. And we're talking less than 5%. You know, you have track meets that will spend so much time introducing athletes when you've got enough time to talk about everyone perhaps during the race, except for a 100 or 200 meter race, that you know, there is so much time in setup and maneuvering people on and off the track that the pace can be very slow. It can be disengaging to the crowd. The thing is, if you view it not as a sporting event, but just as a visceral thing that you hear and you see, there's always eye candy. There's always something moving. And the great thing is that the sight lines in that stadium are quite good. You can't see the lane 9 if you're far enough back in the stands, or lane 8 sometimes, but you're on top of people. You're closer to the outer lane here in at the edge of the grandstand, first row of the grandstand, than you are at just about any indoor track meet in the country. You're closer to the main competition lane, which for us is lane four, because we've got that screwy interior track of three lanes. So spectators in the front row are closer to lane one here than they are at an indoor meet, say up in the Armory, or than they will be here at the Ott Center. You're closer to the action at Franklin Field. It's just an amazing facility that actually works for what we're trying to do.
Give me, in all your years with the Penn Relays, not just as director, but all the Penn Relays you attended, what would you say are a couple of the greatest performances, regardless of event, that you think you saw?
I think the best race I've ever seen was in, I'm guessing, at the year 2007, when Long Beach Poly beat St. Jago of Jamaica on the final lap to win the 4x4. On the final lap, I think there were four teams in contention, those two plus Calabar and I think Kingston College. And it at least three of those teams held the lead at one time or another on the last lap. Possibly all four did. But it was just – it was a race that the cheering was so loud that from the middle of the first turn on the first lap, from then on, I could never hear the announcer. The only person I've ever heard say that they heard the announcer was a person who was sitting in our office over by the tennis courts in the near the Palestra in the Hutchinson Gym, had the windows open, could hear very clearly the announcer, but nobody in the stadium could hear him. The crowd was too loud. You can find that race online in various places. But the in terms of an individual performance, the most amazing thing I saw was 1979 when Rinaldo Nehemiah was here running with the University of Maryland. He'd anchored the shuttle hurdles on Saturday morning, early Saturday afternoon, and well, everybody expected him to run really well there and win the relay for them because he and Greg Foster were the two best hurdlers in the country at the time. And then he finishes second place to Arizona State in the 4x – or was it Tennessee? In the 4x1. But comes back in the 4x2, and he's about 12 to 15 meters behind LSU at the last handoff. And LSU is running one lane to the inside of Nehemiah, who's out in lane six. LSU's in five. And Nehemiah sweeps by an LSU freshman who had had the fastest 200-meter time in the country the year before among high school kids. And Nehemiah just flies by him on the outside, wins by about 5 to 6 meters. And we are just agog over what we've seen. And then comes the 4x4. This is a misty, overcast, drizzly day. And Nehemiah takes a baton about, again, 12 to 15 meters behind Villanova, Tennessee are up there. And he hunts them down. And gradually just closes it up. And with about – as they're coming past where the steeplechase pit used to be in the northeast corner, he suddenly comes out and he did something I'd never seen a quarter miler do. It looked like he just shifted gears and it looked as if he'd popped out of the starting blocks. And he just found a gear and wound up winning that race by 2 to 3 meters over Villanova in Tennessee. It was just the single most amazing performance I've ever seen there by one person.
What is your favorite track and field event?
Whatever is showing the most change that year.
What do you mean?
I'm a statistician. I like to move numbers around. I like to reconfigure this all-time list I'm keeping. Whatever's hot is suddenly my favorite event. It's not just, oh, well, nobody's getting better in this event or that better or that event. Nothing's really changing. But suddenly this event is really good and that event's really good. And that becomes my favorite event at the time, the one I really want to see. But I have an affinity for field events, throws, because growing up on the East Coast, I seldom saw people who could throw far. when I moved out to California, I saw a lot of that. That was a lot of fun. And the hammer throw became probably my favorite event. Javelin throw, because I'd have been a third string javelin thrower on our high school team, but back then, if you ran the 2 mile, which I did, you couldn't do anything else. So I never threw, but I was probably a better javelin thrower than I was a two miler. But then I loved the hurdles. One of my other best friends in high school was our best hurdler. So I loved the hurdles and the triple jump, which had been his best event back in as a junior. So there were those affinities. But I'm also aware that, and I think this is somewhat universal, I find that I'm particularly drawn to middle distance and distance running, in part because I did it, but as a spectator, because when I was growing up, the best middle distance and distance runners, for the most part, were European or Commonwealth nations. And then the Africans started coming in. And so I was fascinated by what we didn't see here in the U.S. On the other hand, I find that Europeans seem to be more fascinated by the sprints than we are as a large track going public, that what you don't have is what intrigues you the most. I think that's what's at play here. So I get a kick out of seeing things I haven't paid particular attention to for a while.
Kind of piggybacking off that answer, is there a track and field event that you feel does not get its due from the public, that maybe people don't appreciate how difficult it is to do what the person's doing, or don't appreciate what goes, and I don't mean the work that goes in, but just the athleticism that goes into doing this event?
Well, you had to throw the word athleticism in there. that compounds the question. I was going to say easily the most unappreciated event are the race walks. You should go out on the sidewalk sometime and try to walk as fast as you can, keeping your heels on the ground, realizing that even if you can't, it's awfully stressful on your shoulders and on your hips. It's a horror. If you can run at all, if you can jog, race walking is just extremely difficult to withstand that grind and try to walk afterwards. But now athleticism, you know, imputes a meaning of that involves dexterity, combination of dexterity, strength, the sense of kinetic motion. And, you know, that's where you bring in something like the hurdles, and triple jump is a beautiful flowing event like that. The more intricate the action, the more it involves all those aspects. So among the throws, that would be the hammer throw most of all. The more basic events are, let's say, the long jump among the jumps and the shot put. That is a brute force and energy that is not as – it's not a syncopated dance the way the hammer or the triple jump seem to be. So I haven't given you any answer, really. I've tried to explain why the answer is – I'm not going to come up with an answer.
And my final question, and this kind of goes along with, you know, I talked about why do the pen relays resonate. If you come across someone who has no concept of the pen relays, give the elevator pitch to them why they should care.
I don't want to pitch you because I'm too invested in it. But talk to anybody in your family. Odds are that somebody in your immediate family knows someone who ran there or whose parents ran there, or they know somebody who ran or goes to it. Everybody in Philadelphia has that kind of a connection, and it's a close connection. This isn't 6 degrees of separation to get there. And if you're a track fan, that becomes a worldwide connection. You can mention Penn Relays and, yes, I've an example of that is also that I'll get calls from grandchildren of people who ran here, or, you know, they're writing an obit. Grandpa did this at the Penn Relays, and you realize, no, he couldn't have done that at Penn Relays. We didn't have that event. What you're thinking of is the Philadelphia Public League Championships that happened at Franklin Field, or the IC4A Championships, or the U.S. National Championships, or the CYO Championships, you know, for his 7th and 8th graders. But it wasn't at the Penn Relays. But that's the big attraction of Franklin Field. And as a result, people have it in their embedded in their mind that, oh, if it was at Franklin Field, it was the Penn Relays. Marty Licori and Jim Ryan in 1971. Penn Relays. Well, no, it wasn't. It was the Martin Luther King International Freedom Games held 2 weeks afterwards. But everybody think lots of people think it was the Penn Relays. It wasn't.
No, it's just kind of the default. But
yeah, it's a default mindset. And that's Franklin Field.
Dave Johnson, thanks so much for coming in. This was great.
Matt, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
And that will do it for this week's episode of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank former director of the Penn Relays, Dave Johnson, for joining us, coming in studio to talk about his career. Now, if you like this show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at One-on-One Pod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah, you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.